This half hour being brought to you by Purdy Insurance. Market Street and Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Auto, home, life, business, boat, motorcycle, RV. Multitude of insurance needs. We all have them. They will do everything to make sure you're fully insured, but also do everything they can to save you money. Customer service so important to everybody at Purdy Insurance. Market Street and Sunbury, go to purdyinsurance.com, and let's bring in Scott Lauber now from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Scott, how you been?
I'm doing well. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing fine. I think the last thing Philly fans expected in April, May, and into June was that at this particular week there'd be a postmortem being written about their team. The finish was, for everybody that follows the team, so unsatisfying. In the end, what did you see that kept them from advancing?
Well, I mean, if we're talking specifically about the four games against the Mets, it boils down to two things. They didn't score, and they didn't get the kind of bullpen performance that they were expecting or that they'd gotten all year long. So those are really the two things. They, but for four innings of game two, they didn't hit against the Mets. It was sort of a different way of quieting them. You know, we were used to seeing when the Phillies went cold during the season, it was because teams would attack them with breaking stuff, often out of the zone. The Mets attacked them with fastballs, and the Phillies didn't hit them, which was a little bit of a head-scratcher. And then, you know, they scored, I think, one run in the series before the fifth inning, and that was the Schwarber leadoff homer in game one. They didn't hold leads late, or they didn't hold the lead in the case of game one late, but they also just, the Mets were able to pull away late in those games against guys like Jeff Hoffman and Matt Strom, who had been so good for the Phillies all year. So that's really what I think the four games boils down to. But what's so confounding about the season as a whole is that they were 40 and 20, let me get this right. They were 45 and 20 when they came home from London in early June, and they basically were a 500 team from there on out. So it's one of those things where you can look at the four games against the Mets and you could say, boy, what went wrong and how do you fix it and do you really want to overreact to four games? Or you could look at the final 3 months and say, why were they so average over the final 3 months, and should there have been warning signs that that there would be an early postseason exit ahead.
All right, so let's play devil's advocate for a moment, Scott, if that's okay with you. We just had the passing at the age of 83 of Louis Tiant. Game 4, 1975 World Series, obviously a bygone era, I will concede. Game 4, he threw 163 pitches and threw a complete game. And the Red Sox needed every ounce out of them they could get. They won the game 5-4, tied the series up at two games apiece. Zach Wheeler threw 111 pitches and had given up one hit through seven innings. In your mind, in modern era baseball, so let's go from a bygone era to the modern era, was there much of a decision to be made there by Rob Thompson?
I don't think so. Because, as you said, modern baseball, right? It's a lot different from the baseball that you and I grew up with. I just turned 48. I remember. I don't remember that World Series because I wasn't born yet. It was a year before I was born. But I do remember baseball in the 80s very, very well. And I remember the Jack Morris game in 87. I remember the Oral Hershiser postseason in 88. I mean, I remember when starting pitching was king, and you would ride your horse for as long as that guy could go, and very often they were trained to go well into games, well past 100 pitches, and then some. So that was a different time, a different era. I think Wheeler was fantastic in game one. Remind me again what the pitch count was.
111, I think.
111. I mean, you know, that's about as far nowadays as a starting pitcher usually goes. I think his high for the season was right around that number. So if you ask him to go back out there, I'm not going to tell you that he wasn't going to throw another scoreless inning up there, but it would have been a departure from the way you'd managed him and your bullpen all year long. There was no reason why, even with a 1-0 lead, you don't trust Hoffman in the eighth and Estevez in the ninth. It's what they had done all year. I think you could make the argument, right, if he was at 90 pitches, could he have given you another inning? But at 111, no, I think that was probably as much as he was going to, you know, as much as you could ask given the way you've managed him and the way he's been managed his whole career. He's a an ace, and I'm not sure that there's a guy that I would rather have on the mound in a game I had to win than Zach Wheeler right now in 2024. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 111 pitches is probably close to his limit.
Fair. I mean, that's why subjects, I always get bothered a bit when subjects get upset with a question like that. I don't mean you in this case, because it just gives you a chance to answer it. It's okay. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's a question. You're allowed to ask a question because what I asked you was an open-ended question. You gave an answer. I think that's why I always get, when people get like, what are you asking that for? I don't know, because it's a question. I'm not questioning you.
Look, I remember.
Yeah, I'm not questioning you.
Well, a game in 2009. I'm going to take you back now, and this is relatively recent history, and yet it's 15 years ago. There was a Sunday night game at Citizens Bank Park where Charlie Manuel left Pedro Martinez in for like 125 pitches or something like that, and we were sitting there going, "Is he crazy? Yeah. He's going to break this guy." I mean, This is unusual, and that was 15 years ago. You know, I think that if Zach Wheeler pitched 30 years ago, is he staying in that game? Of course he is, because he's probably been trained his whole career to go 8 or 9 innings in 130 pitches and then some. But that's not the case these days, and when you've got a bullpen that's built for, you know, normally you're going, you know, in the playoffs, normally you're going to your bullpen in the fifth inning when your starter's at,
that's right,
70 pitches.
Right.
So I think that was a decision too, that to leave Wheeler in as long as he did. It was Zach Wheeler and he was pitching great, and so Rob Thompson rode him for about as long as he could, and then, you know, did what he would normally do, which was go to the bullpen.
See, and that's something like, and Scott, you and I are, you know, we've been in this profession a long time. There's a major difference between asking questions and questioning somebody, right? And that's all it is you're just asking the question, right? And then it's up to you, whatever answer you get, you get. It's not a debate. It's like, I'd like to just know what the thought process was, right?
Sure.
There's a big difference between questioning.
Sure.
What'd you do that for? Now that's questioning somebody.
Sure, and look, when I cover a game, when colleagues of mine, when we cover games, it's, those are the sort of questions we're asking post game, and it's not like a gotcha question or
right,
like we're asking to second guess the manager. We're asking to kind of get his thought process. Take me through why you did what you did, and not like, you know, and you know. In fairness, we ask those questions whether they work or not some of
right,
the time. I mean,
yep,
sometimes I'm as curious to know why he made a move that worked as I am about why he made a move that didn't. And I think, you know, obviously, like you said, some people handle that better than others.
Right.
I think Rob Thompson usually handles it pretty well. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of the nature of the business.
Step number one, by the way, speaking of Rob Thompson in the offseason, was to extend him. What was your thought on that?
Not surprised. You know, I've covered Dave Dombrowski a long time, going back to his time with the Red Sox, and observed him longer than that. And he doesn't often fire managers. He really doesn't.
That's right.
You know, the last time he fired a manager, he fired Joe Girardi in the middle of the season in 2022. But going back, I mean, the Red Sox lost in the first round 2 years in a row, 16 and 17, after winning the division, and he fired John Farrell and went to Alex Cora, who, of course, managed them to a World Series in 2018. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had that maybe in the back of my mind. You know, they go from winning the World Series or losing in the World Series in 2022 to losing one round earlier last year and then one round earlier this year. So it does go through your head, like, boy, you think he might do that. But honestly, what I took out of a 45 minutes of hearing him talk yesterday was, they like their roster. They think that they have a roster that's capable of winning the World Series. They might be right. But, while I think there will be changes to some of that personnel this offseason, it's going to be pretty much the same group coming back, and the onus is on the players, I think. And I think they feel like they've got a manager who players respond to, who has been very successful since he took over in June of 2022. And I don't think Dombrowski felt like what happened in October was the fault of Rob Thompson. So he opted for continuity there. I was a little bit more surprised that the coaching staff will return in full, although I'm not sure what change I would have made there either. But they're bringing back the manager, they're bringing back the coaching staff, and it's on those guys to then, try to affect some change from the players that they have and the players to buy into the changes that they're trying to get them to make, which is, from an offensive standpoint, they want them to use the whole field more. They want certain players to make certain changes specific to them. I think there's going to be a lot of sort of figuring out of, like, how can Trey Turner be a better player? How can Nick Castellanos be a better player? Bryson Stott, and so on and so forth. So, they opted for some continuity in the coaching staff and the manager's office, and they're going to hope that pays off with getting, percentage points better from each player as the season, as they enter next season.
As you go through 162 games, guys are going to land on the IL. Turner was on there for a period of time. Bohm was on there. Everybody seems to take a turn on there, which then brings up the depth of the farm system. In your opinion, what is the depth of the Phillies farm system where they can maybe fill a gap for 2 weeks?
Well, it's a good question because, you look at the guys that they called on to fill in. When Turner was out, it was Edmundo Sosa. He's a major league player, yep. A major league bench player. When J.T. Realmuto went down, it was Garrett Stubbs, and they called up Rafael Marchand, who played very well. They don't have a lot of, I guess there were times where they called on Cody Clemens, they called on Weston Wilson. Those guys came up from AAA. They have a lot of, veteran AAA players. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about prospects, if we're talking about difference makers, potential difference makers who could come in and be regulars, they don't have a ton of guys who are there, who are, on the cusp. Yesterday at the news conference, Dave Dombrowski mentioned Justin Crawford being close, yeah, or closer. Probably not ready at the start of next season, but he could come quickly next year at some point. They are counting on Andrew Painter at some point next year. Again, probably not right at the beginning of the year, but at some point in the year, they expect he'll be in their rotation. That's really it in terms of, difference makers who are on the cusp or getting close. Aiden Miller is a guy they liked very, very much. Didn't want to trade him at the deadline. Very good-looking infielder. But not there yet. He's still he barely scratched the surface in Double-A this year. Yeah. I think that's where he'll begin next year. So, they have a lot of veteran minor league guys who can come in and fill in for a short period of time, but they're still kind of waiting on some of their top prospects to really be there and be guys who they can count on as regulars, so to speak.
Reading between the lines maybe of what Dave Dombrowski said, it's not going to be all 26 guys coming back. So where are the areas that he is targeting beyond individual improvement where maybe he needs a physical, in other words, a different person filling a role? Yeah. Where is he looking?
So, he talked a lot yesterday about the status quo. Some of that, I think, sort of set up an off season in which he knows it's going to be difficult to really change the roster in a meaningful way because, know, they have $220 million tied up in 11 players coming back. That's before they tackle their 9 arbitration eligible players. Their salary, their payroll for the luxury tax came in at about $260 million this year. That was over the second threshold. They're going to be back in that same area next year, if not a little bit higher. So it's not really like a roster that's all that flexible. So he talked a lot about the status quo, but he also pointed out the fact that the outfield is a lot less settled than the infield. We all know that. Left field and center field were areas where they platooned a lot this year, or, you know, didn't have a high-priced player, you know, chewing up a lot of the at-bats. Those, I think, are the two easiest areas for them to change the personnel a little bit. He said something that stuck out to me, which was sometimes you trade good players for good players. Yeah. And, you know, I think the way I interpret that is, like, if you could take a Brandon Marsh, let's say, who they like for different reasons. They like because he brings some energy. They like what he can do against right-handed pitching. He is a perfectly okay platoon left fielder right now who they think could, you know, they still think maybe at some point he'll hit lefties, but he hasn't hit lefties yet. Right. You know, you take a player like that who's a good player and you trade him for maybe a player with a little bit of a different skill set, maybe somebody who makes more contact, doesn't strike out as much. You know, that's sort of, I think, maybe the kind of a move I could see them making in a spot on the field like left field. Maybe they look to upgrade in center field a little bit. Johan Rojas is going to spend the offseason in Florida, in Clearwater. He's going to work on a lot of different things in terms of his offense. But, you know, he's still very much a work-in-progress offensive player who maybe never hits. Who knows? So I do think left field and center field would be the two easiest places to change if they could find the right player, the right match. But, you know, I think they'll be open to a lot of things. He also used the word open-minded yesterday 4 or 5 times in 45 minutes. So, you know, I think that they're going to be looking around to see where could they get better. But, again, there are not a lot of areas on the field where they're going to have a player who's easy to move out in order to get another player in.
How about the ability? What's the opinion of the fourth and fifth starter for them, which is usually in a starting rotation the most flexible parts?
Right. Yeah. I mean, they like their top four very much.
Yeah.
Wheeler, Nola.
Yep.
Christopher Sanchez took a big step forward this year.
No doubt.
And you know, Ranger Suarez had a great first half. Struggled in the second half. Pitched well, I thought, in game 4 against the Mets, or, you know, well enough. I mean, kept them in the game. Did not pitch great, but kept them in the game.
Right.
You know, I think that they're comfortable with those four. Now, they know that they're going to have to do some things with the number 5 spot, which is a little tricky because, you know, you've got Taiwan Walker, who they now are going to have back in spring training to try to win back the fifth starter job. They're not giving it to him by any means because he had just an awful, awful year.
Right.
But there's a lot of money there. I think what they'll try to do, honestly, is they'll try to find a couple of Spencer Turnbull types like they found last year with Turnbull to kind of bring in maybe multiples. Like last year it was difficult. They had a hard time finding starting pitching depth. Maybe they'd work a little harder on that, bring in a couple of guys like that to compete with Walker, and eventually Andrew Painter, they're hoping, steps into the rotation and takes that spot. So it's kind of a fluid situation. I don't expect them to be hot and heavy in the starter market the way a lot of other teams will be. I think that their concern is more how do they round out this offense and how do they fix or how do they reset the bullpen with Estevez and Hoffman both as free agents.
I love talking baseball with you. So I know I eat up a lot of your time, but I appreciate it really, really a lot. Scott, thanks so much. Thanks for the time, as always.
You bet. Anytime, Steve.
Scott Lauber, he's terrific. He's just terrific. Love talking baseball with him. Half hour brought to you by our good friends at Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. As we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK.